So we kind of left off mid-chapter in chapter 21. We're starting a new section, rather, in this section. Famine, numbering, and David's return to God as they, you know, kind of messed up again in the end of 2 Samuel. So here we've talked about the Gibeonites. And remember the Gibeonites? They're the actors, the thespians of the Bible. Remember how they, you know, whenever the people came into the land, they were going to conquer them, and the Gibeonites took the passive aggressive approach and said, "We're just like you guys. We're new here too," and they made a binding agreement with the Gibeonites that they would not harm them, but they made the Gibeonites basically chop their wood and carry water and that kind of stuff. So, so we're picking up in a situation where there's a famine. Chapter 21, there's a famine in the land. Which are famines good? No, famines are bad. Okay, so we're in agreement on that. They had a famine for 3 years. And David, apparently from this text, is talking to the Lord about what's going on. And finally the Lord says, it is for Saul and his bloody house because he put the Gibeonites to death. And so there was a time when Saul was killing the Gibeonites, which, you know, they're not from around here, so you can do that. You're supposed to, you know, clean out the people who are not from there. But they'd already made a pact with the Gibeonites. You couldn't do that. He was going back on the pact that they had made because they had made a covenant. And so this chapter 21 gives us sort of this explanation of that fact. And then, so verse 3, thus David said to the Gibeonites, what should I do for you? And how can I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? And so what do the Gibeonites say? When you're reading this text, what do they want? Do they want to attack Israel and hostile takeover? They said they don't want silver or gold. They don't want those kind of things. What do they want? They want Saul's sons. Saul's the one that did this to them. And so they said to the king, verse 5, the man who consumed us and who planned to exterminate us from remaining within any borders of Israel, let 7 men of his sons be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord. And the king said, I will give them. Now, verse 7 starts with what? But he spared one. Why did he spare this guy? He was Jonathan's son. Again, he had made a pact with Jonathan, right? What's so special about Mephibosheth? He's the cripple, right? Almost every time his name is mentioned, oh, by the way, he's the cripple. Okay, so this is what's going on with Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul. That guy is spared. But then he takes children from his other wives, which Rizpah, the daughter of Ai, they got Mephibosheth and had born to Saul. So this is another Mephibosheth, not the same Mephibosheth. Apparently it was a popular name. And 5 sons of, I wrote over it, Merib, the daughter of Saul. Do we know that name? I think we know that name. If we do a flashback and we go back a few years into 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 19, who was David promised to marry who was the daughter of Saul? It was this lady. This is the lady that David was promised to marry. And then Saul went off and married her to somebody else. David, when he kind of came into his kingship and finally was able to sit on the throne, asked her to come back, and her husband was not happy about that. And so the sons of Barzillai, this is the guy that ended up marrying her, even though David was supposed to, are the ones that are basically given to these guys. What do they do with the children, these men in verse 9? They gave them to the hands of the Gibeonites, and they did what with them? They hung them. They hung them. And it says this interesting phrase, they hung them in the mountain before the Lord. Now, does this mean this was a human sacrifice? Why is this not a human sacrifice before the Lord? God did not ask for this, did he? This is something the Gibeonites decided to do. Now, what's also interesting is that even at this moment, They're still in a famine. God did not ask for these to be killed, but they allowed them to do what the Gibeonites asked for. But even at this moment, they're still in the famine. They haven't yet come out of the famine. And then verse 10 begins this, so these children are hanging, and Rizpah comes, and what does she do in verse 10? The mother of two of the children, what does she do, or two of the men? She's mourning, and what else is she doing? If you have bodies hanging in the wilderness, there's going to be some destruction of those bodies, right? What happens? The birds start circling. So you got wild animals coming in to free lunch, basically, for the animals. But what is she doing out in the field? She's protecting the bodies out of respect for the bodies and her love for them day and night, which is no small thing. We're not talking about like raccoons or something like that, you know, wild dogs and those kind of things that would come. So it's not like an easy task, but she's out there doing it. But what does David do when he's told what's happened? David's told that this lady's out there protecting the bodies. And what does David do? Okay, he's, again, making amends. He's putting all of this in order. It says that David, when he hears about what's going on, he's told about this lady that's doing this. And David went and took the bones of Saul. Remember, the bones of Saul and Jonathan were buried underneath that tree. And they took those bones. And they took these men and they buried them. Verse 14, they buried the bones of Saul and Jonathan, his son, in the country of Benjamin, and Ziklag, the grave of Kish and his father. And thus they did to all at the kingdom that the king commanded. And after that, God was moved by prayer. So it was the Gibeonites getting whatever they wanted. It was sort of the finality of Saul's household being laid to rest properly. And then what was the third thing? Prayer. It was then that God was moved by prayer that the famine was lifted. So all of these things, plus prayer, is what finally took care of the famine. So it wasn't that these events are just this, you know, some have said that this is an offering before the Lord and God wanted you. That is not at all what happened. So if the Gibeonites just wanted David to dance a jig out somewhere, and that was all they wanted, just to humiliate David, and David did that, that would have been enough. But this is what the Gibeonites wanted. Yes? Yes, and this was an atonement situation. Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a pact that they had been killed, and so Saul's people have to die. It was correct. Mm-hmm. And these Gibeonites are not, you know, they're not part of the Lord as far as understanding that kind of thing. So yes, we're not talking about sacrifice at all. So if anybody brings that up, God did not ask for that to happen. It was an outside group. So then we have that now. This same phrase, God was moved by prayer, we'll see later on towards the end of chapter 24, this same phrase in connection with some other events. Now, verse 15 begins the section of going to war with the Philistines. They're always going to war with the Philistines. And in this situation, we are particularly talking about the going out against the Philistines. And we're not timetable-wise, this could have been, because remember it talks about how the kings went out to war in spring, and were specifically given like kind of four times that they kind of go out to war with the Philistines. It could have been that each one of these was a different kind of springtime campaign, or it could have all happened in one year. We don't know exactly. But these events take place at the end of chapter 21. We've kind of been, these have been mentioned recently. But what are they fighting against in this situation? Specifically, when in verse 15, David becomes weary in fighting. What are they fighting against? They're fighting against the Philistines, but what are they highlighting about the Philistines? The giants. The giants are back, right? The giants are back. And so they're fighting against, and David becomes weary in fighting against one of these giants. Now, it's interesting that this giant, Ishbi-Benob, or whatever, however you want to pronounce his name, who was among the descendants of the giant, whose weight, the weight of whose spear was 300 shekels of bronze, which is about, or a little bit over 9 pounds. Which a spear, how many of you have used a spear before? Javelin, anybody? Okay. If you have a spear, you don't necessarily want it to be heavy, right? Because you got to carry it and use it to defend yourself with. Anyway, there's a lot of detail, but that's a big spear, okay? It's a very heavy spear. Not normal. Even they've mentioned the weight of it makes that. And what else did he have with him? A not just any sword. He had a new sword, right? This one's for David. He probably went around telling everybody, I'm going to kill David with this one. It's like, no, I'm not going to kill you with this. I'm going to kill David with this one. So he had a new sword that he intended to kill David. He'd been saving up his shekels of bronze to buy this sword. And he's going to kill David with it. And he almost did. He almost did. David grew weary in fighting against. So this possibly, you know, this is what we're getting. David's been fighting for a while. And so maybe he's just not up on his game as he used to. And, you know, kings, what do? They just sit on a throne, really. So his cardio wasn't what it used to be. And so, you know, so who had to step in to help him? Abishai, which we've seen Abishai several times, right? And it's one of the commanders of the army. So he comes in and helps out. And they kill him. And then what do they tell David after that? Yeah, we that was too close, David. That was too close. We can't lose you. This is the second time he's been told that, right? Remember when they were on the lamb? They told him, you got to stay home. And he did that. And in this situation, they're like, nope, you can't. No, it's too risky. You're staying home. So 18 to the end of the chapter, we have some more giants that they're fighting. They kill all these giants. In verse 22, the four were born to the giant in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David. So David is accredited for the glory. Some of the glory goes to David in relationship because this is his army. But who actually killed the giants? It was his servants who actually, you know, did the steel to body contact to kill these guys. So. That's the events there we have of David's men killing the giants. Chapter 22, we have a psalm. Is that surprising that we would have a psalm in talking about? Not so much, right? This is basically Psalm 18, verses 2 through 50. If you want to write out there beside your, you're probably already in your side notes. This is Psalm 18, verses 2 through 50. And how David begins to talk about God. We have the first four verses. God is seen as the protector. God is given the is in this psalm. David gives God 9 different sort of titles: my rock, my fortress, my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield, the horn of my salvation, a stronghold. In verse 4, he says, "I call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised," talking about the conviction that he has that God will answer. He's proven God to answer his call. God listens to David. He has that relationship with him. Verses 5 through 7, we have this sort of extreme despair that he talks about. The waves of death, these are encompassed him, torrents of destruction. These are some big words, right? Some pretty heavy, heavy situation talking about his despair. But what did he do in verse 7, at the end of verse 7? What did he do? He called upon the Lord. And then what happens in verse 8? And the earth shook. That's super cool. It's one of I love that because here is David in despair, and he calls out to God, and in the earth shook with the response from heaven. That's pretty cool, right? That's a neat thing. That's David's. Now we don't have any incidents in David's life where that actually happened, when he was saved by an earthquake or something. But that's David's feeling in relationship to how God responds. My prayer goes to the throne of God, and the earth trembles. And so it's David's confidence. And you read throughout this psalm about David's. How does he describe God in these? In these next few verses after verse 8, is God kind of a nice little, you know, Santa Claus in this? No, God is not Santa Claus. No, he is angry, right? And it talks about the things that God has done, the power and the thick darkness under his feet. And so very similar to what we see as far as the description of Jesus, right, in Revelation with John. When John sees this terrible image of Jesus, a very powerful image of Jesus. And here we have very similarly very powerful image of God. And we have that in verse 17. We have 17 through 20. God is delivering. He took me. He sent from on high. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from the strong enemy. And he says, "They confronted me the day of the calamity, but the Lord was my support." David believed in that. As you look over his life, he believed that God was his support. As he writes about that here, that God was his support. And so he brought him forth to a broad place, sort of talking about freedom being rescued in that sense. Verses 21 through 25, we have the response of God. David does not claim sinlessness, but we have God's response. "The Lord has rewarded me." And so this is God's response, "according to my righteousness." It's not that David was sinless. I mean, he made mistakes, but is it possible to have sinned but having afterward be righteous again? Yes, repent and return to God. We see David do that. It is possible to have sinned, but repent and turn back to God and be righteous again after that. David really personifies that possibility. And we see that here, that he's returned, that God's rewarded him according to his... He says in verse 22, "For I kept the ways of the Lord, I've not acted wickedly against my God." And so he's saying, I've done what he wants. Verse 26 through 29, we have some attributes of God. "With the kind, you show yourself kind, with the blameless, yourself blameless, with the pure, you show yourself pure. With the perverted, you show yourself astute, and you save the afflicted people, but your eyes are on the haughty whom you abase," right? Those who would lift themselves up, he would bring them down. So this is some attributes about God. Verses 30, basically the rest of the chapter, 30 through 51, talks about basically just praise to God. There's some statements of his accomplishment with God, what God has allowed him to do. Beginning of verse 34, "For by you I can run up upon a troop. By God I can leap over a wall. As for God, his ways are blameless." So he talks about things he's able to do with God. When he's talking about running up on a troop, what is he talking about? Leap over a wall in a single bound. What are we talking about here? Talking about battle. With God, I'm able to go into battle and run upon a troop, a group of men, and fight against them. And we'll see kind of how that plays out in a little bit. But he's talking about the things he's able to do with God. We've seen that against Goliath. We've seen that over and over again with his battles. Even other people talk about how ferocious he is in battle and his men are in battle. But he attributes those things to God. God is the one who makes that possible. Verse 33, "God is my strong fortress." And so he talks about all these things that God is to him. He trains, verse 35, "He trains my hands for battle so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze." How many of you have used a bow before? How many of you used a recurve bow? Like the one that compound bow. That's cheating. But if you use like a long bow, or if you've done camp and you've done So when you pull that back, what happens when you get to the end of your stretch? Can you sit there and hold it all day long and just kind of, I don't know what I'm going to shoot at? It's tension, right? And you start shaking. Have any of you used a bronze bow? No, I'm imagining the tension on that one's outside of my range of possibility right now. So he's talking about these feats that God is able to do in relationship to, "You have also given me the shield of your salvation, and your help makes me great." And again, all these things that God is able to do with God over and over again. So here is this psalm, Psalm 18. I would encourage you to read over this psalm and look at how David talks about God. And I would encourage you to kind of skim through the Psalms and see how David or the psalmist describes God. And even using attributes of warfare in relationship to his description of God. And so it's rather amazing. Verse 47, he says, "The Lord lives, and blessed be my rock." And so in contrast to idols. And then at the end, verse 51, "He is a tower of deliverance to his king and shows loving kindness to his anointed, to David and his descendants forever." And so this is David saying, he's taken care of me, he's taken care of his anointed, he's going to take care of my descendants. He's made that promise to me, which includes whom, by the way? Includes Jesus as part of that, you know, descendants. So that's a rather interesting statement in the whole context of the Bible. Chapter 23, we have the last words of David. This may be out of order, so we're going to have some other things happen with David, especially when you start getting into 1 Kings. But these are just the recorded last words of David. But doesn't mean he's, you know, does a rosebud scene and dies at the end of these words. These are just what we're given here. So now these are the last words of David. David, the son of Jesse, declares, "The man who was raised on high declares, the anointed of God of Jacob, and the sweet psalmist of Israel, the Spirit of the Lord spoke by me, and his word was on my tongue." Which he's claiming what in relationship to the word he writes? He's claiming divine inspiration here, okay? They're not just cute poems, they're divine inspiration, right? The messages are from God. And we see that, especially in relationship to some of the prophecies we have in the Psalms. Psalm 22 is a huge prophecy of the crucifixion of Christ. So we see inspiration, and they're claimed to be inspired here. "The God of Israel said, 'The rock of Israel spoke to me, he who rules over men righteously, who rules in the fear of God. It is a light of the morning when the sun rises, or is as the light of the morning as the sun rises, the morning without clouds, when the tender grass springs up from the earth through sunshine after rain. Truly is not my house so with God. I've ruled this way. I've been a righteous ruler, and my household has been that way. For he has made an everlasting covenant with me." You can write out there beside that 2 Samuel 7:12, where he makes that covenant with David, that there will continue to be a descendant on the throne. 2 Samuel 7, verse 12. "He is ordered in all things and secured from all my salvation and all my desire. He will not indeed make it, will he not indeed make it grow? But the worthless, every one of them will be thrust away like thorns." It's interesting, a lot in the Psalms and Hebrew poetry, you have the positive displayed, then you have the negative. You have the good and the bad. And what happens here, what description do we have of the bad here in these last words? Yeah, well, how does he describe these worthless, every one of them? What does he just compare them to? Thorns. Thorns, right? Any of you just love hanging out with thorns? I'm going to go pick the thorns out of those other... Yeah, nobody likes doing that, right? Even when you wear gloves sometimes, you're like, how did that go through? And so here in this situation, the worthless, every one of them will be thrust away like thorns because they cannot be taken in hand. They cannot be handled. They can't be worked with. But the man who touches them must be armed with iron and the shaft of a spear. You got to poke at them, push them away, and use iron to do that. And they'll be completely burned with fire in their place, which is the same kind of thing we see the imagery used by Jesus in the gospel is talking about those who are worthless. They'll be gathered up and burned because they are of worthless. They're not used for anything. So, again, this comparison. And if you think about, especially David talking about one who rules in the fear of God, these are last words. Who might he be saying them to? Solomon, perhaps, who's going to be the next king, right? So do you think these are going to be wise words for Solomon? I would contest that some of the wisdom that obviously God gives him the wisdom, but some of the things David handed down to Solomon, this is one thing he said, you've got to rule wisely and rule in the fear of God. But we'll talk more about Solomon later. So All right. Chapter 23, verse 8 begins a rather interesting section of Scripture about a rather interesting troop of men. Who are we going to start talking about now? The mighty men, right? The mighty men. David's mighty men. We have all these names, so if you guys are planning on having any children soon and want some awesome names to choose from, these are some pretty powerful names. Yes, sir.
I got a grandson.
Oh, there you go. There you go. There you go. So here we go. Here are some names. So these are the names of the mighty men whom David had. Now, if you want to write out here, 1 Chronicles chapter 11, 1 Chronicles chapter 11, verses 10 through 46, kind of goes through a very similar list, has this list as well. 1 Chronicles writes about this or talks about it in connection whenever all these people start coming to David after the kind of the destruction of Saul, whenever they fell to the hand of the Philistines. And all these people start coming to David is when the chronicler writes about the mighty men and lists them very similarly. So he goes through these names and talks about some of the things that they've done and these captains. I practiced this, but I don't know if I'll be able to do this. Hosheb Bashebeth, a Tachamite, chief of the captains, who was called Adino the Esnite, because of the 800 slain by him at one time. So this guy killed 800 men at one time. He's an operator, okay? He's an operator. And after him was Eliezer, the son of Dodo, which, don't read into that, okay? It's not a bird or anything, all right? One of the three mighty men with David and defied the Philistines who were gathered at the battle. And he rose and struck the Philistines until his hand was weary and clung to the sword. So here's a guy who's swinging a sword around so much that his hand froze to the sword. Like it had cramped up around the sword. And, you know, I don't know what they did. If they soaked it in hot water, icy hot, or something to get his hand off the sword. But here's what he did. And so when people finally showed up, because they all ran away, right? They ran away, and people finally showed up. What did all they have to do was just kind of pick up the armament and kind of go through and pilfer through the dead is all they had to do once he got done. And then Shema, the son of Agi the Herite, the Philistines were gathered into a troop, and there was a plot of ground full of lentils, and the people fled from the Philistines. But he took a stand in the midst of the plot. This would be a cool scene to see, by the way. Here's everybody running, and he just puts his feet flat down and just takes on the guys. I could, in my mind, this is kind of like a cartoon anime thing, as you see him put his feet down, and the camera spins around on all the guys running at him. Anyway, it'd be really cool. What did he do to him? He killed all those guys. He killed them all, and it was a great victory. So these are the three of the mighty men, the chief mighty men, and it talks about how they went down. And what story do we have told for us here, beginning of verse 13? What did these three do for David? They're holed up somewhere. David's like, man, I could really go for a Coke right now. It's like the equivalent of a Coke. It wasn't, you know, obviously they didn't have corn syrup back then. So they couldn't have Coke, but so there was water from a certain spring that he wanted, that he just, you know, he was talking to his guys, because they're sitting around talking about stuff, and I'd really like a drink from that. And these guys are like, hey, we could just, you know, fight through the Philistine line, go down, fill up a canteen, and come back and give it to David. He'd really appreciate that. Yeah, let's do that. And so they decided to do that very thing, which is no small thing. It's not like they just kind of tiptoed through there and said, hey guys, time out, I want to get some water. They had to fight through the enemy lines, get the water, and then fight their way back. And then what does David say? Oh, that's awesome, thank you so much. What does he say in relationship to that? He pours it out. But why does he pour it out? Why does he pour it out? It's not like, no. No, why does he pour it out? There were so many people that killed. They could have been killed doing it. It was at such a high cost. He didn't feel worthy to drink. I can't do that. It's come at such great cost. And so he does not. And he says, be it far from me, O Lord, that I should do this. And so he does not drink that. And then Abishai is mentioned. Again, we've talked about him. He's one of the chief of the 30. But he doesn't gain to the height of the other three. And then some other ones are mentioned. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada. Okay, this is interesting. Verse 20. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man. So he's the son of the son. He's the grandson of a valiant man of Kezul who had done mighty deeds. So their family business was what? Being valiant. That's kind of cool, right? Their family business was being valiant. And so here's a lineage of valiant men. And so he talks about some famous people he killed. He killed a lion in the middle of a pit on a snowy day. Killing a lion in a pit on any day would be difficult. I don't care if it's 75 degrees, partly cloudy, right? It's going to be difficult to kill a lion, and he does it on a snowy day. Yes, sir. Yeah. Lion-like men. Well, we're going to be talking about attributes of these men. So lion-like men doesn't mean they had, you know, well, maybe they did have flowing manes, but we're talking about more of their attribute in battle than necessarily their animalistic characteristics. They compare David at one point to a she-bear separated from her cubs. So it's that kind of analogy that's being used here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In this case, it's probably closer to just their characteristic in battle. So, do what? Craven? Okay, no. So, they killed him. Okay, this is also very cool. What else did he... He killed an Egyptian. All right. How did he kill this Egyptian? First of all, this is a rather large Egyptian. So, this Egyptian has a spear, and he goes in there with what? Yeah. So the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, and he went down to him with a club, snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hand, and killed him with his own spear. He's an operator, right? He's, wow. Okay, and then Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, he had a name as well, honored among the 30, and David appointed him as a guard. And then he goes through a list of these individuals in the end of chapter 23. But these are the men that David ran with. Okay, these are the men that went and killed giants. These are the men that were that stood around him, his closest men when he went to fight. These were the men. It's interesting that we have a mention of the three mighty. Whenever in Gethsemane, when Jesus goes to pray, what does he do with his disciples? Do you remember? He put some over here, and then he took three closer to him and went and prayed. Someone said that the way he did that was the same thing that a king would do if he's out in battle in a field. If a king is in battle when he's in the field, he stages his bodyguards and has three that are closest to him. I don't want to read too much into that, but this is seemingly the kind of thing that David did as well. I think that's rather interesting. About all of these, but what's verse 39? Who's mentioned here? Uriah. That's awkward, isn't it? Yes, sir.
We keep saying the men did it, but they didn't do it by themselves.
No, I realize that. Yes, as far as the power of God helping them with it. Yes. No, I realize that, but they still had to walk out there. They didn't Wingardium Leviosa or anything. They had to walk out there
and.
What's that?
We just have to get that from it, I guess.
As far as God helping them with it? Yeah. Well, the chapter before, the psalm kind of talks about God giving him, David the power to do those kind of things. David mentions that in relationship to fighting his original giant, right? And talking about God will help me fight him. So you are right. We kind of have to read between the lines in relationship to that. And God was blessing those who were around David. God was blessing David in what he was doing. And because David was doing what God wanted him to do, those blessings kind of came upon the other people who were around him. The same thing happened with Abraham. God was blessing Abraham. And because Abraham was, if you were in contact with Abraham, you were going to be blessed as well. Lot is an example of that, and he became rich because of his association with Abraham. It's the same thing with these men in battle. Because they were with David, they were associated with him. And we have 5 minutes. Do we have 5 minutes still? Okay, 5 minutes to cover a whole chapter. Verse 20, chapter 24, we have the census that's taken. And you might want to write out here Exodus chapter 30, verses 12 through 13. If they were going to take a census, they would have to take half a shekel from each person they took a census from. And it appears from other censuses that were taken that God was sort of the initiator of the census, that he was the one that asked if a census was needed to be taken. Numbers 1 through 3, it was God that commanded the census in that time. And so as far as why there is some apprehension about having this census, they say, David says, go a number. And he says, number from Dan to Beersheba. So if he says number from Dan to Beersheba, who is he saying? Everybody. We're going to talk, everybody needs to be counted. If we're talking about Dan, we're talking about the most northern and southern cities, everybody's going to be counted. And so there is some apprehension on behalf of Joab, right? He's like, I don't think we need to do this. What does he say? Joab said to him, now, may the Lord, may God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of the Lord our king are still can see. But why does my Lord the king delight in this thing? Why do you want to do this, basically? And so the king prevailed, and they go and do this. 1 Chronicles chapter 21 gives us a parallel to this as well. And it says in that parallel that Joab did not count the Levites. And God always said, do not count the Levites. And Joab did not do that. He did not count them. And he tells them 800,000 valiant. In Israel, there's 800,000 valiant men who drew the sword. And in the men of Judah, there were 500,000. So how many hundred thousands do we have? A lot. Yeah, 1,300,000. So over a million. It's 1 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 6, saying that Joab did not number the Levites or the Benjamites. And they were not to number. Numbers chapter 1, verse 49 says, do not number the Levites. But then he says, I've sinned. I've sinned in numbering the people. Did he not collect the shekel? We don't know exactly the circumstances, but he has sinned. And he sinned greatly. And he repents to the Lord. And he says, take away your iniquity. And the God basically says, a prophet was given, and Gad, David's seer, go and seek to David. And thus says the Lord, I'm offering you 3 things. Choose for yourself one of them, which I will do. Which is like, go pick your own switch, right? Okay. So Gad came to David and told him and said to him, shall 7 years of famine come to you in your land, or will you flee 3 months before the foes while they pursue you, or shall there be 3 days of pestilence in your land? Now consider and see and what answer I shall return to him who sent me, him, capital H, who sent me. Then David said to Gad, I am in great distress. Let us now fall in the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man. He said, I don't want to do that again. I do not want to run away from enemies again. He says, let me fall into the hand of God. And so basically they get pestilence. They roll a dice, they get pestilence. How many people die in verse 15? I'm sorry? 70,000 people die. You made a mistake. 70,000 people die because of your mistake. It's pretty heavy. When the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented from the calamity and said to the angel, stop, it's enough. Relax your hand. And the angel of the Lord was above the threshing floor. And David spoke to them when he saw the angel who was striking down the people and said, behold, it is I who have sinned. And he says, it is I who have done this wrong, but these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and against my father's house. And so he's saying, please, this is rather noble of David to say this. And so Gad came to David in verse 18, and David went up according to the word of Gad, just as the Lord had commanded him. And what is he supposed to do? To make an altar, right? And he says, and he comes to this guy and he says, I'm going to buy the threshing floor from you. And this guy says what? No, I'm just going to give it to you. You can have it. There's like this angel here with the sword still outstretched. You can have it. It's all yours. What's that? But what does David say? I can't do it. I cannot offer to God what costs me nothing. Is it an offering if it doesn't cost you anything? What are you offering? You're offering somebody else's stuff. Right? So he says he buys it from him for it, and then he offers it to the Lord. And thus the Lord was moved by prayer, and the hand of the plague was held back from Israel. You might want to go over and look at 1 Chronicles chapter 21, and kind of gives us some more detail in this situation. It says that David did not like that sword that angel had. He was kind of afraid of that sword. I would be as well. So that's where we finish 2 Samuel, and we will pick up with 1 Kings in a few weeks from now. Thank you very much for your time this evening. Thank you.